Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Just a few minutes ago, I had the great pleasure of speaking to seven Americans who are now free. Free from their imprisonment or detention in Iran, out of Iran, out of prison, and now in Doha, en route back to the United States to be reunited with their loved ones.
Five U.S. citizens jailed in Iran have arrived back in the United States after Washington and Tehran agreed to a prisoner swap that involved the unfreezing of $6 billion in Iranian assets. We'll get the latest and talk about the protest movement in Iran a year after the death of Mahsa Amini. Then we look at how the U.S. helped Pakistan get an IMF bailout with a secret arms deal for Ukraine.
Based on secret documents from both the American and Pakistani side, we can report that the U.S. pressured the Pakistanis to begin producing weapons for the Ukraine war effort, and the Pakistanis asked the United States to help them get an IMF loan. That emergency IMF loan was greased in part by the funds from the weapons sales.
We'll speak to The Intercept's Ryan Grimm about Pakistan, as well as the shutdown showdown on Capitol Hill. Will House Speaker Kevin McCarthy's standoff with far-right Republican Congress members lead to a shutdown of the federal government? And here in New York, 149 climate protesters were arrested Monday after they shut down the Federal Reserve in a major act of civil disobedience.
The reason is that the Fed is the one institution that actually has the power to regulate the banks that are financing oil, gas, and coal projects.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has publicly accused the Indian government of assassinating Hardeep Singh Najjar, a prominent independent Sikh leader and a Canadian citizen. In June, Najjar was shot dead outside a Sikh temple in the city of Surrey, British Columbia, by two masked gunmen who escaped in a waiting car. His murder sparked widespread fear across Canada's large Sikh community. 3 years before his killing, India's government designated Najjar a terrorist. On Monday, Trudeau blamed India's government for orchestrating his assassination.
Any involvement of a foreign government in the killing of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil is an unacceptable violation of our sovereignty. It is contrary to the fundamental rules by which free, open, and democratic societies conduct themselves.
Mr. Trudeau reportedly raised the assassination with the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, as well as President Biden. On Monday, Canadian Foreign Minister Melanie Joly said she had expelled India's top intelligence official in Canada. In response, India expelled a senior Canadian diplomat. India has rejected Trudeau's charges, calling them absurd and politically motivated. Climate scientists are sounding the alarm over record low levels of sea ice off the coast of Antarctica ahead of the start of spring in the southern hemisphere. Sea ice helps to prevent the rapid flow of ice from Antarctica's glaciers into the ocean, which can drive global sea level rise. Satellite data show 930,000 fewer square miles of sea ice extent surrounding Antarctica compared to the September average, far below any previous winter level. Walter Meyer, a researcher at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, told the BBC, quote, "It's so far outside anything we've seen, it's almost mind-blowing," he said. Here in New York, police arrested at least 149 climate protesters Monday after they flooded Manhattan's financial district for a day of peaceful protests. Activists are demanding banks stop funding coal, oil, and gas projects. More protests are planned for today. In Massachusetts, nine members of the environmental movement Extinction Rebellion were arrested Monday as they peacefully occupied the office of Governor Maura Healey to demand an immediate phase out of fossil fuels.
It's going to be hard. We know that. But how much harder is it going to be the longer we wait? We've already waited too long. The people who are in power now are the ones who need to take action now. Stop passing the buck. Stop pushing it down the line. We only have a few years left before it's too late.
We'll have more on this week's historic climate protests later in the broadcast. A Minnesota judge has dismissed criminal charges against three indigenous water protectors who were arrested while protesting at the construction site of Enbridge's Line 3 pipeline in 2021. The three women, Winona LaDuc, Tanya Albid, Dawn Goodwin, were arrested on the banks of the Mississippi River on ceded Anishinaabe land as they sang, danced, and prayed near construction crews. In a landmark opinion delivered Monday, Aitkin County Judge Leslie Metzen wrote the women were exercising their rights to free speech and to freely express their spiritual beliefs. The judge dismissed the charges against them in the interests of justice, she said, including, quote, to criminalize their behavior would be the crime. Five U.S. citizens released from prison in Iran Monday have arrived back in the United States following a rare prisoner swap agreement between the United States and Tehran. They were freed after the U.S. unfroze $6 billion of Iran's oil revenue and released five Iranians held in the United States. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke to the five Americans after their release.
I can tell you that it was for them, for me, an emotional conversation. It's easy in the work that we do every day sometimes to get lost in the abstractions of foreign policy and relations with other countries and forgetting the human element that's at the heart of everything we do.
We'll have more on Iran after headlines. Here in New York, the 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly got underway Monday with an urgent call to action on the environment. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said nations need to work urgently to end the triple planetary crisis of climate change, pollution, and biodiversity loss. He also called for a global rescue plan to meet the UN's 17 sustainable development goals, including the elimination of extreme poverty and malnutrition.
In our world of plenty, hunger is a shocking stain on humanity and an epic human rights violation. It is an indictment of every one of us that millions of people are starving in this day and age.
Heads of state from at least 145 countries are attending the UN General Assembly this week. Conspicuously absent are the leaders of four of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council: China, Russia, France, and the UK. President Biden's devoting a substantial portion of his speech today to advocate for increased support for Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is attending the General Assembly for the first time since Russia's invasion in early 2022. He will then head to Washington, D.C., where he will meet with President Biden, but will not again give a joint session of Congress address. The New York Times reports a deadly September 6 strike on a crowded marketplace in eastern Ukraine was the result of an errant Ukrainian air defense missile, not a Russian attack, as was widely first reported. The New York Times cited evidence, including missile fragments, satellite imagery, witness accounts, and social media posts that strongly suggest the catastrophic strike was the result of a Ukrainian radar-guided surface-to-air missile that went astray. At least 15 civilians died, 30 more were injured. Meanwhile, China's foreign minister has begun a four-day trip to Russia. The visit by top diplomat Wang Yi to Moscow comes after he met with White House officials in Malta over the weekend. On Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with China's vice president on the sidelines of the U.N. General Assembly ahead of a possible high-level U.S.-China summit later this fall between Biden and Xi. Mexican journalist Emilio Gutierrez Soto has been granted asylum in the United States after 15 years of fighting for protection. Gutierrez and his son fled Mexico in 2008 after receiving death threats over Gutierrez's reporting on corruption within the Mexican military in the northern state of Chihuahua. They were detained for 7 months, eventually released to live in the United States while an asylum appeal was pending. Democracy Now! Spoke with Gutierrez by phone in 2017 as he was jailed at a U.S. detention center in El Paso, Texas, awaiting possible deportation.
Well, if we are deported, that obviously implies death. Why? Because ICE, under the Department of Homeland Security of the United States, by law, must give a report to the immigration authorities of Mexico and the consulate. And the immigration officials in Mexico have no credibility. It's impossible to trust in them. To the contrary, many of those officials, many personnel at the consulate or immigration service are caught up with organized crime.
In labor news, striking auto workers have expressed skepticism over President Biden's comments siding with the UAW. United Auto Workers President Sean Fain has said he will not endorse Biden's 2024 reelection run as the union, quote, expects actions, not words. Several Democratic members of Congress have joined the picket line in recent days, including House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, who made a trip to Detroit Sunday to express solidarity. Meanwhile, Donald Trump said he plans to skip the second Republican presidential primary debate in California next week to speak in Detroit. Trump has accused the current UAW leadership of failing its members and appealed for the support of auto workers. UAW President Fain has also been critical of Trump. This all comes as the strike of some 12,700 auto workers has entered a fifth day. This is UAW member Stu Jackson speaking from a picket line in Wayne, Michigan.
We don't want to wait 4 years to get it. We need it now. We need it now. You know, and that's the way they've been doing us. You know, these bonus checks, we don't need bonus checks. We need cost of living allowance. You know, we need to keep up with what's going on in the economy.
And more than 60 members of Australia's parliament from across the political spectrum have written an open letter urging President Biden to halt his efforts to prosecute Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, who's an Australian citizen, faces espionage and hacking charges that could see him sentenced to up to 175 years in prison for publishing classified U.S. military and diplomatic cables, including evidence of war crimes. Assange has been held in London's infamous Belmarsh prison since 2019, awaiting possible extradition to the United States. In their open letter, the Australian lawmakers call on the U.S. to abandon its prosecution of Assange, writing, quote, it serves no purpose, it is unjust, and we say clearly, as friends should always be honest with friends, that the prolonged pursuit of Mr. Assange wears away at the substantial foundation of regard and respect that Australians have for the justice system of the United States of America, unquote. The letter appears as an ad in the Washington Post. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Five Americans released by Iran as part of a prisoner swap have arrived back in the United States. They were released Monday, then flown to Qatar, which helped broker the deal in which the United States agreed to drop charges against five Iranians in the United States. In addition, the Biden administration cleared the way for Iran to access $6 billion of its own money that had been frozen in a bank in South Korea. As part of the deal, the money will only be available to Iran to purchase food, medicine, and other non-sanctionable items. Three of the prisoners released by Iran have been identified publicly. Siamak Namazi, who's been detained since 2015, Murad Tabaz, an environmentalist jailed since 2018, and Ahmad Sharghi, who was also arrested in 2018. The names of the other two have not been publicly released. The five prisoners flew on Monday from Tehran to Qatar. They were joined by two other Americans who'd been barred from leaving Iran. Secretary of State Tony Blinken praised the deal.
Just a few minutes ago, I had the great pleasure of speaking to seven Americans who are now free. Free from their imprisonment or detention in Iran, out of Iran, out of prison, and now in Doha, en route back to the United States to be reunited with their loved ones. Five of the seven, of course, had been unjustly detained, imprisoned in Iran, some for years. Two others had been prevented from leaving Iran. I spoke to them after they landed in Doha. I can tell you that it was for them, for me, an emotional conversation. It's easy in the work that we do every day sometimes to get lost in the abstractions of foreign policy and relations with other countries and forgetting the human element that's at the heart of everything we do. But today, their freedom, the freedom of these Americans for so long, unjustly imprisoned and detained in Iran, means some pretty basic things. It means that husbands and wives, fathers and children, grandparents can hug each other again, can see each other again, can be with each other again. So it's a day that I'm grateful for.
Of the five Iranians who had their charges dropped, two have asked to stay in the United States. Another two have returned to Iran, and the fifth is going to an undisclosed country to be with family. Some Republican politicians in the United States have criticized the deal. Texas Congressmember Tom Cotton described the deal as, quote, shameful, and accused the Biden administration of, quote, paying ransom to the world's worst state sponsor of terrorism. That's Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. But family members of the detained Iranian Americans praised the Biden administration's efforts. In a statement, Ahmad Sharghi's sister Neda said, quote, "This is my brother, not an abstract policy. We are talking about human lives. There's nothing partisan about saving the lives of innocent Americans, and today should be a moment of American unity as we welcome them home." The prisoner swap also came as the Biden administration announced new sanctions on Iran's former president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and Iran's Ministry of Intelligence for their involvement in what the Biden administration described as, quote, wrongful detentions. The prisoner swap took place 2 days after the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini, who died in police custody September 16, 2022, just over a year ago, after she was arrested by Iran's so-called morality police, accused of not wearing her hijab properly. Her death sparked months of protests in Iran, a severe crackdown by Iranian authorities. Rights groups estimate 500 people were killed, more than 18,000 arrested over the past year. Ahead of the anniversary, Iranian police detained Mahsa Amini's father, warned him against commemorating his daughter's death. To talk more about the U.S.-Iran prisoner swap and U.S.-Iran relations, we're joined by Nigar Murtazavi. She is an Iranian-American journalist, host of the Iran podcast, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Nigar. Why don't you start off by talking about the significance of this trade, of the deal that was made, and then we'll talk about the protests.
Good morning, Amy. Let me just make a very quick personal note. This is also very emotional for many of us Iranian Americans. As an Iranian American journalist living in exile who can't travel back to my homeland, specifically because of this issue. This could be me or family members. I actually know one of these prisoners, former prisoners, personally. So this coming back is just a very emotional scene for most Iranian Americans to watch. As far as the policy, I think this is just an example of successful diplomacy between two adversaries, two rivals. It was a long process, very complex process. Iranian and American diplomats didn't even meet in person for these negotiations, for this complex agreement. There was very heavy mediation involved by trusted partners on both sides, mainly the state of Qatar, where diplomats would literally shuttle between hotels where Iranians and American diplomats were staying, and essentially brought this home and were able to choreograph that whole process of the unfreezing of Iranian assets and also the freeing of the five each prisoners on both sides.
And Nigar, what do you make of the timing of this release coming on the eve of the United Nations General Assembly meeting, just as President Raisi of Iran comes to New York? What do you make of that?
Well, I'm not exactly sure how much of this was timed, although it is a pattern that when domestic issues and problems, or I would say repression and dissent increases, Iran has been trying to do more outreach and more sort of external gains or diplomatic achievements. And this could be one of those. But it's also, let's not remember, this was about a year of intense negotiations, about eight rounds of those indirect negotiations that I talked about, and it was very much reliant on a financial transaction, this big sum of money, $6 billion that was sitting in South Korea for years, had to be transferred to Europe, be converted, and then go into, be transferred to a bank in Qatar where the Qatari government will have oversight. So I guess both sides wanted this to be done as soon as possible, and that money was, what we got reporting was that it was transferred finally last week, and so these were the steps that came right after it. But I wouldn't be surprised if the Iranians were also trying to time it with the arrival of the president, the Iranian president, into the U.S. in New York for the General Assembly.
And of course, this $6 billion, which some Republicans in the United States are calling a ransom, is actually Iranian money that was frozen by United States sanctions. Could you talk about the sanctions and its impact on the Iranian economy and on the people of Iran?
Sure. Yes, it's essentially ransom paid out of their own pockets. Someone was comparing this to a person going to the bank and taking a hostage and asking to withdraw money out of their own account, essentially. So this was money that was frozen by South Korea oil revenue at the request of the U.S., or essentially in fear of U.S. sanctions or punishment. And the U.S. basically green-lighted to South Korea, or allowed them to unfreeze this money. But the law as far as sanctions hasn't changed. This is an existing humanitarian exemption that has existed under Republican and Democratic administrations when it comes to sanctions law, that certain purchases, very limited purchases, are allowed even for a country that's heavily sanctioned. What are those purchases? Food, medicine, and limited medical supplies. So what's happened is basically a logistical financial transaction where this money was moved from South Korea, converted from Korean won into euros, and now it will be sitting in banks in Qatar with direct oversight by the Qatari government, who will be responsible for paying for the transaction. So the Qataris will not be paying the Iranians. They will be basically paying the suppliers for these humanitarian transactions, and with some oversight also from the U.S., as Qatar is a trusted partner by both sides. So I think this argument is essentially against any humanitarian exemptions to sanctions, which existed as far as long as sanctions existed, and it gets to the core of the essentially that exemption, which is allowing food, medicine, and medical supplies, no matter what, under any sanction conditions.
Nigar, Can you tell us who the five Iranian Americans are, or why don't we know two of those people where we do not see their pictures? And also who the Iranians are, who two are asking to stay here, two went to Iran, and another to a third country. What were they charged with? They weren't all jailed here, were they?
No, so I'll tell you briefly. On the Iranian side, two have asked, and their families had asked, to remain anonymous. It's just the personal decision of the families. It's sort of that balance. Do you go all out with the media attention to bring more pressure and increase the chance of your loved one being released? Or do you keep quiet and try to resolve this with quiet diplomacy? You know, there's two theories, two ways of doing this. And these two families decided to keep it quiet, and they assumed it would increase the chances of them being released. And I think they still try to remain private and not have the names out. So it was as a personal decision of the detainees and their families. The other three, Siamak Namazi, Emad Sharghi, and Murad Tahbaz, Iranian-American. Murad Tahbaz actually British as well as American, so triple nationality. Siamak Namazi, an Iranian-American businessman, had been held the longest since 2016 in Iran. He's essentially, as he says, has been left behind or forgotten by multiple administrations over the years of his detention. Emad Sharghi, also a businessman from this area, the D.C. area. And Murad Tahbaz is an environmentalist, Iranian-American environmentalist from the Connecticut area. On the U.S. side, the U.S. detention or the Iranian nationals on the U.S. side, it was all related to sanctions violations. So very specific category, not violent crime, not anything domestic, but essentially federally enforced sanctions and exports violations that these Iranian nationals were charged with, that essentially the government dropped the charges. But some of them were already residents of the United States. One was a resident of Canada. So essentially, I think they're going back. Again, it's a personal decision. They're going back to where their lives and families were, or that decision is just a personal decision. And one or two have decided to go back to Iran. So it's been very specific categories. And this was also similar to what happened under the prisoner swap during the Obama administration.
Nigar, I know you have to go, but I wanted to ask you about this anniversary of the killing of Mahsa Amini and her father being arrested, the state of the protest movement in Iran right now, as the president of Iran addresses the UN General Assembly.
Sure, I have a little bit of time. The anniversary was essentially prepared with a very heavy security presence, pressure on families, pressure on activists, universities, anyone who could potentially show any leadership in bringing about a mass movement. Again, a state, the government essentially tried to prevent that with lots of preemptive pressure. But the dissent continues. The grievances are still there. They haven't been addressed, economic, political, and cultural. And I think what we saw over the past year after the death in custody of Mahsa Amini was nothing short of a mass movement and also essentially a cultural revolution. Women and girls said, enough is enough. You can't kill a woman for how she's dressed, which is one reading of the religious attire. And they started defying the mandatory hijab in ways that we haven't seen before. The courage, the bravery, putting their lives and their bodies on the line and saying, I want autonomy, bodily autonomy. I'm going to start dressing the way I want. Young girls, school girls. So the bravery and the courage has been amazing to watch, and it's been constant, ongoing over the past year and still continues. But as far as mass protests, like the way we saw last year, the government and security forces have tried very hard to prevent that.
And have there been any concessions by the government in the past year in terms of the rights of women in Iran?
I don't think we can call them concessions, but women have been able to push the government back essentially by force, by saying, I refuse. I am risking my life. I'm risking arrest. I'm risking my career, my job. Women have been fired. Businesses have been closed. They get fined. They get tickets if they drive without the headscarf. But nevertheless, they continued. I think the leap or this giant push that they made over the past year would eventually happen maybe in the next decade or two, but it just accelerated it. The killing or death in custody of Mahsa accelerated it, with women essentially channeling this anger into more resistance and more fight. And women in Iran on the ground tell me there's sort of an unspoken sisterhood, a solidarity, that when they see each other defying the law and not wearing the hijab, they get even more courage, more bravery, and feel like they're not alone. And now there's just so many of them. The Iranian public, the way it looks, has been very, very different. It's dramatically changed since it was last year, and I don't think the government can push it back to where it was before the killing of Mahsa Amini.
Nigar Murtazavi, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Iranian American journalist, host of the Iran podcast, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, speaking to us from D.C. Next up, we go to Ryan Grimm on how the U.S. helped Pakistan get an IMF bailout with a secret arms deal for Ukraine. And we'll talk about, here in Washington, D.C., the shutdown showdown as House Speaker Kevin McCarthy faced